Motorcycle Man.
Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to episode 203 of the Motorcycle Men podcast and another interview for your listening pleasure. Hey, thanks for tuning in and listening to this show and, of course, listening to all of the Motorcycle Men episodes. If you'd like to help the show out, you can go over to the Motorcycle Men website at motorcyclemen.us, and there you can click on a link. There's a donate button to help us out with a singular PayPal donation. And another way you can help us out is give us some feedback. Go over to iTunes. Give us a rating, good, bad, or different, doesn't matter. And while you're at it, also send us an email to motomenpc@gmail.com or go to our contact page on the website and send us a note there. We appreciate that. The Motorcycle Men podcast is brought to you by Tobacco Motorwear. For the best motorcycle jeans for men and women, turn to Tobacco Motorwear Company out of California. Dave and the crew over there make Kevlar-lined selvedge motorcycle riding jeans that will outperform everything out there. Now, you don't believe me? Well, take a look at the Tobacco Motorwear video on their website with the owner, Dave, being dragged behind a motorcycle wearing a pair of his jeans. What other jean company would do that? Nobody. Tobacco has also the California riding shirt, the McCoy waxed canvas riding jacket, and their new Kevlar-lined journeyman pants. All are available in various colors and men's and women's sizes. I am the proud owner of a pair of their jeans and the California riding shirt, both of which I wear for each ride I take, and they look just as good as the day I got them. And as always, all tobacco gear is made here in the USA. So for men's and women's riding jeans, shirts, jackets, and graphic tees and accessories, go to tobaccomotorwear.com. There is a special link for Motorcycle Men listeners who want to order from Tobacco Motorwear in the show notes and on the Motorcycle Men website homepage. Or you can call them at 747-666-5741 and tell Dave and the crew that the Motorcycle Men sent you. And make sure that when you order, you use that coupon code MOTOMEN when you order. Scorpion Helmets. For the past 15 years, Scorpion EXO has been dedicated to offering high-quality, innovative motorcycle helmets and technical apparel at an incredible value. Some of the world's best helmet and apparel designers spend countless hours developing and testing Scorpion EXO products to ensure that each and every Scorpion EXO helmet and garment will surpass user expectations. The foundation for a Scorpion EXO is safety, comfort, value, and innovation. This is supported by Scorpion's unique position in the manufacturing process, owning and operating their own state-of-the-art manufacturing facilities. Their development and manufacturing expertise provide the Scorpion EXO brand a level of quality and attention to detail that cannot be surpassed. So visit more, go check out ScorpionUSA.com. I have a Scorpion EXO carbon helmet, and I could not be happier. What a great helmet. So check those guys out. And also, you want to go over to Shinko Tires, born from an experienced tire company. Shinko has been producing top-quality motorcycle tires since 1998. Whether if you are riding a sport bike, scooter, off-road, or dual sport, or cruiser, Shinko has a tire to suit your needs and riding style without breaking the bank. Why go with the same old tire you've been using? Get a better ride and a better feel. Now, I did, and I do feel the difference, and I really couldn't be happier. So if it's time for new tires for your bike, think Shinko. Go to ShinkoTireUSA.com and tell them that the Motorcycle Men sent you. Hey, Viking Bags. If you ride a cruiser, street, dirt, or ADV bike, you need bags. You need to visit VikingBags.com. Viking has a wide selection of motorcycle luggage for most bikes to suit and meet your needs. Made with both textile materials and leather, Viking Bags is the affordable alternative to outfitting your bike for short, medium, and long-distance touring. So visit VikingBags.com and tell them the Motorcycle Men sent you. Hey, the Motorcycle Men podcast is supporting David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. If you would like to help out and be a part of something that actually makes a difference, donate today to David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. So go to davidsdreamandbelieve.org to donate. Links will also be in the show notes. Now, the names Ted Simon, Ewan McGregor, and Charlie Borman, and Sam Manicom are synonymous with motorcycle travel around the world. They open the doors to the adventure spirit that rumbles in everybody. But they are not the only names. There are many others who, sadly, have done the same journey that went unrecognized. While it may be commonplace today, in the 1980s, it was considered a major achievement suited really only for the most daring of daredevils and perhaps those with maybe a death wish. But what if you were a British woman in your early 20s who just wanted to get away? Well, my guest today was just that. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Motorcycle Men podcast. And here we are with another interview, and my guest today is none other than Elspeth Beard, all the way from where are you located right now?
I'm actually in Surrey in England, about 30 miles south of London.
Oh, okay. And we're here to talk to Elspeth about what she did a long time ago. So, Elspeth, why don't you... Well, first of all, welcome to the Motorcycle Man podcast. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you very much for inviting me on here. It's very good. Thank you.
You're welcome. I actually contacted you several months ago when I had heard the Motorcycles and Misfits podcast talking about you. And I sent you an email and suggesting that you listen.
Yeah, I think it was you that told me that it was actually on. And I had no idea that they'd been speaking about me at all. So that was very funny.
You did finally speak to them, didn't you?
I did. I think because you put me in contact with them, I think. Anyway, I then did an interview with them about a month later.
Oh, great. Yeah, see, I started some trouble now, didn't I? All right, so why don't you tell us briefly about who you are and what you accomplished?
Okay, my name is Elspeth Beard. I'm now an architect. I have my own practice in England, just south of London. But I'm in the middle of my architectural training. I decided to go and ride my motorbike around the world. And that was back in 1982. I was 23 years old, and I decided I just needed a bit of a break.
So in 1982, you're in your third year of architect training, and you decided to take this little break, and you decide to ride around the world on your motorcycle. Now, at the time, not many people were doing that, and it was considered quite a task, especially for a woman. Now, was that the driving force you had, despite all the lack of support for doing this trip?
No. I mean, I think it was something that gradually just kind of came about. I started riding bikes when I was about 16. I think I got my first motorbike when I was 17. And that was just a small Yamaha YB100. And it was simply to get around London, sort of easily, efficiently. At that time, I never really kind of thought that motorbikes would become such an important, you know, part of my life. But after about a year of that bike, I got a bit bored with it, so I decided to buy myself a Honda 250, and then a year of that, I got a bit bored with that, and then I bought myself my BMW 600.
Oh, so you have a habit of getting bored with motorcycles?
Well, they didn't quite go fast enough for me.
Oh, okay.
And I just always wanted to, I seem to want to sort of go that little bit further. And the bike, you know, the 250 just kind of limited me to the distances that I could travel. So I then bought my 650, my 600. And I think it was that bike I suddenly realized, actually, now I can seriously, you know, get to places. And so the first trip I did was around Scotland. Then I rode around Ireland. Then I went around Europe. And then in the summer of 82, I flew out to the west coast of America, and I bought myself a BMW, a really old 75/5, and I rode that across to the sort of east coast. And it was probably that. So, I gradually was building up the confidence. I was learning about my bike. I was learning about traveling on my own. And then it was a whole series of events that happened to me the following year in 1982 that I decided basically I needed to sort of escape. I needed to get away. I was at kind of a sort of time in my life when I didn't really know whether I what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to carry on with architecture. I was feeling a bit lost. And so it was a mixture of events that happened to me at that time. So I decided
So the first thing that pops in your mind is, let's ride the motorcycle around the world.
Well, it does sound a little bit strange, but actually it was. I don't know. I kind of wanted to get away from... I just wanted adventure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I wanted to get away... just somewhere completely different. I didn't want to be at home in England and to, I don't know, to be reminded of all the things I was trying to get away from. And I thought the best way to do that is just to sort of escape. And when you, you know, when you're on a bike and you're having to deal with the day-to-day things of, you know, of traveling and everything, your mind is occupied and it's just a sort of major, you know, distraction really from all the things you want to leave behind.
Right. Now, when you announced, okay, I'm going to ride my motorcycle around the world, what was the reaction and did you get any support on that?
Well, I think everybody thought it was a complete joke when I first said it. Everybody just thought it was just a big laugh. And then as I said it more and more often, and then as I started to prepare my bike, and I was obviously starting to get quite serious, then, I mean, my parents did everything they could do to try and stop me. And my friends, I don't know, they just kind of went along with it, but I got the feeling they all thought that I'd be back in a month or two.
Yes, so nobody took you seriously.
No, it was kind of humouring me a little bit. In a way, it was a kind of slightly humouring me, and she'll be back and whatever, and so. But I didn't let him. You know, I I was always somebody who did my own thing anyway, and mm-hmm. I didn't pay too much attention to what people thought or told me I could do or not do. So I just, you know.
All right. Well, now, what motorcycle did you use for this?
Well, I bought it in 1979. It was a 1974 BMW R60/6. So it was, the bike was already sort of 7, 8 years old and already had 45,000 miles on her. So she was a fairly well-used bike when I started the journey. But it was all I could afford and it was all I had. And I think, you know, if you wait until the perfect moment when, you know, you've got all the money, all the bike, all the time, all whatever, then you just never do these trips and you just have to, I only left with about £2,500, which I knew wasn't nearly enough money,
right.
But it was the same thing. I knew if I was going to work and stay at home for another year and earn some more money, mm-hmm. then I might change my mind and I might not go, or I'd find another reason or find a sort of reason why I wasn't actually going to go. So I just decided to leave, you know, with the bike I had. I sort of did the best I could to, you know, prepare her. And I went with the money I had and that was it. And I really just, I didn't plan that far ahead. I just hoped that I would get to New Zealand or Australia where I'd have to work again. And yeah. I just kind of took it day by day, or not quite. When I started, I'd plan a kind of week ahead. But I certainly just took each country at a time. Yeah. I didn't think of the whole global trip. It was too much in my mind to try and think about.
Little pieces at a time, right? Just a little bit at a time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Little pieces at a time.
Tell us about the bike a little bit more. Now, you have this very interesting setup with regard to the cases that
you
had on the bike.
Well, those cases I actually made when I was in Sydney in Australia. So when I left the UK, when I was riding across America, I just had a sort of soft bag. So I had the kind of throw over panniers, just a bag strapped on the back seat and a tank bag.
Okay.
That was it. But when I was in Sydney, I met this Australian guy who had ridden his motorbike from Sydney to Europe about 2 or 3 years earlier. And he had literally completely encased his bike with aluminium. I mean, it was...
I did see the pictures of that on your website. Yeah.
It was absolutely extraordinary what this guy did. But anyway, he was a little bit of a, you know, oddball, but he was a lovely man. He was really, really sweet. So he persuaded me that I needed to make myself my own aluminium sort of, you know, luggage system. So I spent every weekend for about 3 months working with him. Mm-hmm. At his house, sort of building these literally from scratch. So it was just sort of angled bits of aluminium and sheets of aluminium that were just riveted. Because in those days, of course, you couldn't buy any of that kind of gear for bikes.
No, yeah, no.
Yeah, so if you wanted hard luggage, you just had to make it yourself. And that's what I did.
Hey, very interesting and great job you did, actually.
I mean, it didn't look great. I know it didn't look great, but it was very practical.
It served a purpose, right?
Yeah, it was cheap to make. It was easy to fix. I could carry lots of stuff. It was perfect. It was really, you know, it was good.
Now, with regard to your route, I know you said you took it in little pieces, but did you actually plan the route that you were going to take?
Not really. I mean, I got to America, and I mean, I traveled across America, as I said, the year before. So there were bits of the states I'd already seen. There were certain bits that I wanted to go to. So, but a lot of my trip, and I would say that actually for the whole of the journey, was very much governed by the, you know, I would always tend to follow the warm weather. I don't like riding when it's cold. I don't like riding it in the rain. So from you know, New York, I headed up north, you know, up to Niagara Falls, and then literally from there went straight down to, you know, New Orleans, where it was nice and warm, and then I rode across, you know, the southern states. And I really did, in most of the countries where I traveled, I would sort of follow the weather as best I could.
Okay. Yeah, smart move. You don't have to worry about heated gear or anything. There probably wasn't any back then. I don't know.
There wasn't any.
You're right.
It didn't exist.
Oh, great. Now let's step back a little bit. So now you started by shipping this bike to New York. Now, that's what you were going to ride across the states now. Now, I know you have done it once before, but with regard to the conditions and the people, did it meet your expectations?
Yeah, I mean, I started off heading west because I felt confident I could get across America because I'd been there before, because it was English speaking, roads were good, you know, civilized country, all that kind of thing. I felt, because for sort of me, from, you know, from the UK to head west, to go to Turkey and Iran and India and Pakistan, you know, to start off my journey traveling through those kind of countries. I mean, it was a really daunting thing for me.
Oh, sure.
And also, you know, my money was limiting and I had absolutely no idea how much money I would need. And to travel overland from, you know, from the UK to Australia, all through, you know, the Middle East, Far East, India, you know, I knew I would need far, far more than my £2,500. So America, I saw as a sort of relatively easy country to, you know, to travel across, which it was. I mean,
it was.
I mean, I camped a lot. I camped a lot in the national parks, which was great. I stayed cheaply in, you know, in motels all across America. It was easy. Well, it was easy. Some of the, you know, the days were long. I mean, it's a big country, America. So there were some long days, you know, riding. But apart from that, it was relatively easy.
Was it the easiest of all the traveling you did around the world?
I would say it probably was, actually, yes.
Oh, wow. How about that? Well, listen, One thing I do want to say, on behalf of all American motorcyclists, I would like to apologize for how you were treated by some of the people while you were in America, because I did listen to your audiobook, and I was really like cursing some of these people why they would treat you the way they did. That, I know that must have been difficult, and probably maybe even a little bit disenchanting about the whole thing, but I'm sorry you had to go through some of that.
No. Well, I can tell you, I experienced far, far worse in many other countries. So
yes, as I heard on your audiobook. So now you're off to Australia. You got your bike shipped there. Now, did you have to wait for your bike to arrive?
No, yes. So what I did is I shipped it, because actually to ship my bike from LA to Auckland in New Zealand was like really expensive. And in fact, I'm pretty sure then all of the shipping routes went from LA to Sydney, and then it went from Sydney to Auckland. So it was like really, really expensive to get my bike there. Mm-hmm. So I decided to ship my bike straight to Sydney, which took about 5 or 6 weeks, I think.
Yikes, wow.
And during that time, I spent a week or two in Hawaii, and then I spent about 2 months in New Zealand, sort of hitching around and everything. So unfortunately, I didn't get to ride my bike in New Zealand, which was great because it's an absolutely stunning country.
That's what I hear, yeah.
Motorcycling country, I tell you, it's amazing. But unfortunately, I just didn't have with my limited funds, I just couldn't afford to get my bike there. So, and I then flew and rejoined my bike in Sydney.
Oh, there you go. And this next question is pretty much covers every place you went, but how were you received by the people though when you mentioned what you were doing?
Well, I got all sorts of weird reactions. I mean, some people, when I said it, they just kind of almost ignored what I said, as if they hadn't actually heard it or they didn't believe it. They just kind of said something completely different about a completely different subject.
Kind of like blew it off completely, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then some people kind of said, oh, wow, that's amazing. But that was about it. I don't think anybody could really kind of grasp it. And I think it was a very... I mean, now so many people travel and they ride bikes around the world, and it's not, you know, I'm not saying it's an everyday thing, but there are, you know, a lot more people who are on the road now. Right. But in those days, I met one other person riding a motorbike overland in 2.5 years.
Wow.
That's how many people were were riding bikes. I mean, of course, I'm only on one road, but it was very, very unusual then.
Well, you did your trip not too many years after Ted Simon did his. Correct?
I think Ted got back in 79, I think, and I left in 82. So I was just slightly after Ted.
Did you hear about what he did and maybe that sparked you?
Well, I'd heard about his journey.
Oh, okay.
But that was a kind of about it. I didn't read his book, I have to say. I didn't. I mean, not for any other reason. Mainly because I don't find reading all that easy because I'm dyslexic. So I didn't read. And also, I kind of wanted to have my own journey.
Of course, yeah.
I didn't read anything. I didn't read about anybody who'd done any traveling anywhere. I just went out and found out for myself.
Just did it.
Just did it.
So now while you're in Australia, you took a job to help pay your way. And it must have been a little bit frustrating for you because you were working and not riding. But were you itching to get moving?
Well, it was funny, you know, because I had this strange, because whenever I got to places, like, you know, I mean, when I first got to places, I had kind of itchy feet and I wondered, but actually very quickly, I actually kind of settled in, and I found it quite hard then to move on. Like when I was trying to leave Sydney, I think I spent like 3 or 4 days just trying to leave, and I almost left and then I didn't, and then I almost left the next day. I thought, oh, I'll go tomorrow. And there was something about leaving the you know, the kind of safety of a home, because then I was staying with some friends of mine, and you know, and it's, you know, the road seemed like a very lonely, empty place.
Yeah, you got and, comfortable though.
Yeah, and I kind of got comfortable, and it was kind of quite hard. I mean, obviously, once I made the move and I was on the road again, I was going, "Oh yes, this is it." You know, but I did have to push myself to kind of move on every time I sort of stopped for any length of time.
Yeah, wow. So now you're in Queensland, and you had a little incident there. You want to tell us what happened?
Yeah, that was my first accident, and probably my worst, actually. I was riding on one of the dirt roads in the outback, and my front wheel just went into a huge sort of pothole, which from all accounts was almost the exact size of my front wheel. And so it kind of locked in, and then the whole the bike just flipped over, and I cartwheeled it down the road. And I was really lucky because about 2 days beforehand, I'd met up with Tom and Ewan. And Tom was an English guy who had bought a Honda when he was in Sydney. And he was just sort of, you know, riding around Australia. And Ewan was a Kiwi and he was Pillion on the back. And so they were right. And literally, we've been riding, I think, for, a 2 days or something. And then we were trying to get out to this national park, so they were riding behind me. So they saw the whole accident. But the ambulance had to come 189 miles to pick me up.
Oh, wow, so really?
It really was in the middle of nowhere. Wow. And I was incredibly lucky that I was with them because I actually landed on my head.
Hey.
So, and even to this day, I have no memory of the accident. I have, and it actually wiped out my memory of 2 days before the accident, which I still, to this day, I have no recollection of at all.
That's kind of scary. Wow. So were you finally glad to leave Australia?
Australia, I kind of have this love-hate thing with Australia. I mean, it's a beautiful country, and I love the openness and the vastness of it and the extraordinary landscapes. And, it is a very special place.
Yeah.
But it's also, at the same time, it's incredibly harsh. And I found it, and I think, you know, when I left Sydney, I had this kind of idea that it was going to be sort of easy, a bit like America. It was all going to be kind of cruising into the sunset and lovely roads, and and it just was not like that at all. It was like hundreds and hundreds of miles. I mean, it was 400-500 miles, day after day after day. It was in kind of 45 degrees.
Oh, geez.
And it was the flies and the dust and the road trains and the heat and the half the roads were just all dirt everywhere. Then I had floods in when I was in the South Australia. I mean, it was just a challenge. Every day was just a struggle and a challenge. And
you know, it's funny when you mention that. I've listened to a lot of audiobooks of people who have traveled through Australia, and the road trains, the kangaroos, and just the travel through that region, like you explained, was just always so much of a challenge.
Yeah. Well, it was just really, it's just really harsh and intense. It's just, it doesn't do things, it's just full on, everything. It's just, and it's just trying to, and when you're like on your own in the outback trying to deal with that, I found it mentally and physically exhausting. Oh, I really did. Absolutely exhausting.
Now, from there, you went to Singapore in Asia, correct?
I took my bike to Singapore because, again, I actually traveled through Indonesia, but I did that using public transport,
right?
Because it was really difficult. In fact, I think it was almost impossible to ship your bike from island to island to island to island. So, which is what, you know, because Indonesia is just a series of little islands.
Right.
So I decided to ship my bike, also for money, it was cheaper, straight to Singapore. And then while it was en route, I spent 2 months traveling up through from Bali to Java, up to through Sumatra. And then I rejoined my bike in Singapore, and then I rode up through Malaysia and Thailand.
Wow. But you had a little bit of an incident again in Asia, or somewhere in Singapore, right? Something about a dog?
Oh, no. Well, I had an incident in Singapore in the fact that all my stuff was stolen. All my money, passport, everything was stolen. Complete nightmare. But then I had my second accident in Thailand. So by this stage, I'd ridden all the way up through Malaysia, right up to the northern bit of Thailand. And then I tried to get through Burma to India, but I couldn't because Burma was closed. All the land borders were closed. So I had to ride all the way back down through Thailand to Penang to catch a boat across to India. And I was in a little bit of a hurry, which is never a good thing. So I was riding and this dog literally shot out from behind a truck. I mean, I didn't even see it. I don't think I even touched the brakes. It was just kind of under my wheel. And it knocked me clean. I mean, it was a big dog and it knocked me clean off. And I slid up the road and into a ditch. But I was very fortunate that it happened right outside this sort of Thai farm. So all the whole family came out and they helped me haul my bike out of the ditch. And anyway, I ended up staying with them for about 4 or 5 days while I kind of managed to repair, because I was really badly bruised and I broke my toe, actually.
Oh, boy.
And my bike was, ripped all my panniers off, so I had to get fixed those. And so there was quite a lot of work just getting myself on my bike back on the road again. And then on the very last day, I went to say goodbye to the mother in the kitchen, and as I was saying goodbye to her, I looked over and I saw the half eaten remains of the dog that I'd run over. I suddenly realized what I've been eating for the last four days.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that kind of like that must have really been a little bit of a shock to you.
Kind of was, but to be quite honest, by that stage, I mean, I'd eaten, I'd eaten ostrich, I'd eaten alligator, I'd seen rats on spits, rotating on spits in Indonesia. I'd found huge cockroaches in my food. So you kind of get, I mean, I know it's, but you kind of.
Yeah, but a dog.
I know.
Oh my! So now, from there, you went in through India and Pakistan as well, and that whole region. Did you have any difficulties pushing on through there?
Oh well, I have to say, I think India was probably the country I struggled with most, and I think it was just the multitudes of people.
I can imagine.
And I think if you're not used to it just comes as quite a shock. And I think they had never, ever seen anything like me or my bike before. So I tended to attract a huge amount of attention. And literally every time I would stop anywhere, within about 3 or 4 minutes, I would have 50 people around me. And it just does get quite kind of wearing. You kind of feel it, just this pressure the whole time of being stared at, and it's like almost this slow Chinese torture. Well, it was for kind of me. I'm sure other people deal with it, but I found it extremely extremely wearing, and I did struggle in India a lot. But fortunately, so I went straight up to Kathmandu, and I spent about two or three months up in Nepal, which was fantastic. I actually love Nepal. And when I was in Nepal, I met this Dutch guy, and he was the only other, biker that I met in the whole of the trip. And he had actually emigrated to Australia, decided he didn't like it or didn't want to live there. And sent all his things home, but decided to ride his motorbike back. So he was riding overland from Sydney.
Oh, okay.
And we agreed to meet up in India in about a month's time because I wanted to do a different route and he'd already done it. Blah, blah. Anyway, so we met up in Agra about a month later. And then we from then on, we traveled overland all the way back to Holland, his home. And certainly when I started traveling with him, it made a huge difference, especially in India, a massive difference.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it was great. It really was. It almost turned into a holiday from a kind of just trying to survive day after. So yeah, it was amazing when just having somebody there to talk to. And
oh, of course. Yeah, so I'm looking at the pictures on your website, and just if not anything else in that region, the scenery was absolutely beautiful.
Well, we managed to get the main bits. Yeah, so from Agra we went around Rajasthan, which was beautiful, and then we went right up to Leh and Ladakh up in the mountains, and that was absolutely stunning. It's got to be one of my favorite parts of the whole world. I actually loved it up there. So then we unfortunately had to ride back down, and then we had a bit of a battle trying to get out of India through into Pakistan. So, but yeah, no, parts of India are beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful country. It's just the multitudes of people.
Oh yeah,
I just found quite hard to deal with on my own.
Listening to that part where you were trying to get out of India, I felt so frustrated for you.
I know. I mean, honestly, it was just unbelievable. You couldn't. I mean, it was just.
Yeah, it was like, did anybody know what they were doing at all?
No, but actually it was because I suddenly realized that nobody knew what they were doing and that the people at the border had no idea what a permit actually looked like. Because nobody had ever issued a bloody permit, that they took this piece of paper and accepted it as a permit. I mean, you know, it was just this bizarre. It's just, but that's what traveling is all about.
Yeah,
these
kind I guess.
Weird, bizarre situations. And you have to think on your feet really, really fast. But that's good. You know, it teaches you a lot of skills.
I guess if that's what you want to call it. So now, through this whole thing, your bike has been holding up relatively okay. You have a few scars here and there. And I'm very impressed, by the way, that you were able to like rip this bike apart completely throughout this whole thing. You did most of your repairs yourself, right?
I pretty much did all of them with the help of my Haynes manual, I have to say.
Of course.
But yeah, I remember when I bought one of my early bikes, I can't remember, I think it was my Honda, I took in to some place for them to service it, and I got treated so shoddily that I vowed after that I would never, ever get anybody to service any of my bikes again, and I never have. So after that, I bought myself some tools, I bought myself manuals for all my bikes, and I just taught myself how to do it. And I have never in 40 years had anybody service or touch any of my bikes. I've done it all myself. And my old R60, which I've still got and I still ride it, and it's still running.
Wow, that's awesome. Wow. And how many punctures did you get on this ride?
I actually only got one puncture.
Really? Oh, well, geez. Now that, I'm really impressed with that.
I know, but Robert, who I was traveling with from India, I think he had four. Wow. I don't know what he did, but I only had one.
Different types of tires, I guess. I don't know.
I think it was just the way he used to ride. He was I used to ride more carefully.
At any point during any of the repairs that you had to do, did you find yourself, I need this part and I can't get it? Did you ever run across that?
Well, yeah, but sort of, but you didn't. I mean, I remember in Northern Thailand, my battery stopped charging and I had this slightly bizarre. And anyway, so I was sitting on the side of the road. So my, you know, the red light on the dash sort of stayed on when you opened the throttle, so I knew my battery wasn't charging and there was some fault in the charging system. But it ended up this old guy came along you know, he was asked me with his, you know, with sign language what the problem was, and I kind of showed him. I pointed at the red light and revved up the bike, and the light stayed on. Anyway, he kind of, asked me to come down the road. So I followed him down the road, and it turned out that he owned one of the largest alternator factories in northern Thailand.
Wow.
And so we wheeled my bike in, and we took the whole thing apart, and we found that one of the diodes on the diode board was faulty. So we unsoldered the diode board, and he found one new diode, which he soldered in. We soldered it all back together again, and it's still on my bike today.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So you just have to, because the people in those countries, they never had access to spare parts, and they were very used to just kind of making things and making do and fixing things, and so it was very much that sort of attitude. And a lot of the time, I mean certainly from Pakistan all the way back through Europe, I didn't have any back brake, because all the oil from my rear drive was going into my brake shoe, so I had no. And you needed a special seal. Well, you know, I can't get a special seal. Well, you just learn to ride the bike and don't use the back brake if you haven't got it. And, wow. You know, you just kind of have to make do with what, you know, my headlight got smashed in India. So I didn't have a headlight from India all the way back home. I just didn't ride at night. And, you know, you just have to sort of adjust the way you do things. Wow. And the way you ride, and my clutch, that's right, my clutch started to slip when I was in, when I was in Pakistan. And so I just learned the art of changing gear without using the clutch.
Yeah.
And so I only used the clutch to first pull away, and that was it. And the rest of the time I changed gear, and I just didn't touch the clutch. Wow. Just to save it.
Wow.
So
okay.
You just have to adapt. It's all about adapting.
You did. That's for sure.
Well, yeah, I had to. Yeah. So, yeah.
So now you arrived back in Eastern Europe. I guess that must have been a huge sigh of relief for you, huh?
It was. I mean, I think, you know, once I got out of Iran and crossed into Turkey, I remember it was the very first time I thought, I've done it. I'm going to make it home. And I think that was the very first time I thought that. And then Turkey was relatively easy. And then we just raced through Europe. I mean, I was desperate to get home. And it was right at the end of the year, so it was really cold.
Ooh.
And we needed to get over the Alps before there was too much snow.
Yeah.
So we literally, I think, from Greece or from the, you know, the border with from Turkey into Greece to Holland, it was like, you know, like 7 or 8 days. I mean, it was really quick.
Yeah.
We were just so, you know, really just wanted to get home.
Did you notice a real sudden transition to the quality of the roads once you crossed into Turkey?
The roads in Turkey, because Eastern Turkey, they were sort of fairly rough. And I mean, they were okay. They were sealed. And the roads gradually improved as you kind of went further and further west.
So, yeah.
And then by the time I got into Greece, the roads were pretty good. And then obviously when I got into Austria and Germany, and then there was, you know, beautiful roads. So,
yeah. Now, when did you arrive back in England?
I arrived back, it was November sometime in 1984.
Must have been a little chilly, huh?
It was absolutely freezing. And also, I didn't have much gear. I mean, I'd been riding in really hot climates for
right.
like 2 years, and all I had was like a leather jacket. I had jeans. I had these boots that the zips were broken, so I had this. They were freezing. I had gloves that were full of holes because they were the same pair I wore all around the world.
So the thought of buying gear along the way never occurred to you, huh?
No, it never occurred to me.
All right, how many miles have you done up to that point?
I think I did just over 35,000 miles.
Wow.
So it was good.
Wow. Now, as I understand it, the reception that you received, or even the acknowledgement of what you had done, had gone virtually unrecognized. That must have been like devastating to you.
It was. I mean, I think, yeah, I was, well, I think I was very hurt by my kind of, not all of my family, but my parents' reaction was, you know, I found quite sort of hurtful. I think they struggled to understand the whole trip anyway. I mean, certainly my mum did. And I think once I was home, she just kind of thought, right, that's it. That's over and done with now. Now you can, you know, become a kind of normal person and you know, settle down and get a job or finish your architecture and be normal. I think a lot of it was that people couldn't really understand, or they couldn't, you know, relate to my journey and what I'd experienced. And it was, you know, it was, it was a very tough journey. And I can remember one of my mum's friends saying to me, now you've had a holiday for 2.5 years, it's time you get down to some real work. And I just looked at her and I thought, you just have no idea what I've been through. Absolutely, yeah. No idea at all. So it was just, they didn't understand. I think that was the problem. It was it was difficult. Yeah. And that made me feel very isolated. I didn't feel I had anybody I could talk to. Nobody wanted to listen to my stories or what I'd been doing or my adventure. It was all you know, I sort of, you know, retreated, I suppose, into myself. Yeah. And it took me, you know, quite a few years to, you know, feel I was joining the real world again, if you know what I mean.
No, I understand. Now, but did any of the media outlets, like magazines, newspapers, anything, at any point, did they recognize or show interest in what you did?
No, I mean, I contacted some of the magazines, and I remember there was one particular magazine, I won't mention who it was, and they and I told them where I'd been, and I listed all the countries that I went to, and there was kind of this silence on the other end of the phone, and then there was a slight pause when I finished, and he said, well, it's not really a round the world trip, is it? And I went, oh, what? And he went, well, you didn't go to South America. So I went, oh, okay, all right. And just literally, I just put the phone down. And then the next issue of that magazine, the next month's issue, there was like a 2 or 3 page article about this guy who rode his bike from England to the south of Spain and back.
That's it?
That's it.
Wow. How does that rate over what you did? I don't know.
Well, I don't. I think it was just, it was almost, I never really understood it. And I was just a bit too, you know, like ahead of my time. I think the whole you know, motorcycling world or scene, certainly in the UK then, was still a very much a kind of male only club.
Oh, sure.
And I don't think they wanted to kind of acknowledge that a woman had ridden around the world on her own. It was just, and they certainly weren't going to put it in print. So they just kind of, you know, sort of ignored me. It was easier. It was just kind of easier, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I found it very odd. I mean, I didn't expect to be, you know, to come back and be hailed as some great, you know, heroine or anything. But I expected a little bit of it. I mean, there was one article in one of the in one of the weekly news, newspapers, the motorcycle press, but it was a pretty awful. And it basically said that I'd done this trip, but I'd sort of done it, and it had all been paid for by my parents, and I was some rich
no.
kid. I was a rich kid, and I'd just been swanning around the world with my parents' money.
Wow.
It didn't It didn't actually say that, but it was all written between the lines.
Yeah, it was implied, definitely.
It was implied on at every single opportunity. It was implied. And so that was it. That's the only acknowledgement I got. And then there were all these other letters came in the following week saying, you know, fighting, you know, what was it? Biting the hand that feeds you and, you know, rich bitch. Oh, it was just, I thought,
But you've been recognized now. Now people are aware of what you've done. And now you're there.
I know. And it's absolutely fantastic. And actually, I'm actually really glad that it's taken that kind of time lapsed between coming home, because it sort of made me, I mean, all the, you know, the lack of interest just made me get on with my life. And I just literally put everything in a box. I left it all there. I thought, right, that was, you know, a part of my life. It's done. And then I've done a kind of billion things since.
Yeah.
And I didn't look back on it. It was just a sort of, you know, a small part of my life. It was a very important part of my life. And I think if I'd had any kind of recognition and I'd written a book or I'd done that when I got back, my life would have been completely different. I maybe wouldn't have actually finished off my architect training. I don't know. You know, right. But I would have gone down a different path. So I'm really glad that I had that time. And although at the time it was hard to, you know, to deal with that, it was, you know, it was good in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Did you get moments? I mean, I'm sure you do. I know for myself, when I do something that I consider for myself a little daunting and when I accomplish something, you fall into this melancholy mode. Did that strike you when you think back about the trip you did?
What, now even now?
I'm sure back then you did.
I don't know really. I think when I got back at the time, I was just struggling with so many feelings and emotions, and I was actually even more confused when I got back than I was when I left, and I was hoping the trip was going to sort me out.
Maybe you should have just turned around and went back out.
It just gave me, well, I kind of did. That's exactly what I felt like doing. I felt like getting back on my bike and just going. And in fact, shortly after, I did get back on my bike and I decided to go to ride down through back to Turkey, through to Syria and to Jordan, and then to travel through the northern bit of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really odd. I kind of got halfway through Europe. I think I did actually get to Western Turkey, and I just couldn't see any point in it. And so I just turned around and came home. And somehow, without the sort of light at the end of the tunnel or this goal to get my bike back home, it almost just didn't have any meaning. And I actually realized I was still exhausted, and so I just turned around and came home. And then I felt even more lost because I thought, well, I'm not actually, you know, I don't have a place on the road because I don't actually like that anymore. I don't feel I have a place at home. I don't know what job, you know, I just didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. And it was, you know, a very, very hard time for me.
Now, do you still have the bike?
I do still have the bike and I still ride the bike. I did actually when I have to say I probably didn't ride it for about 5 or 6 years when I was doing up the water tower, because I bought this water tower that I live in.
Yes.
And that was a kind of another major, major project. So I didn't ride it for about five or six years. And then she was off the road, I think, for about 15 years, I have to say. And then about 3 years ago, I got her back on the road, and she's now fully roadworthy. And I ride her again, so it's good.
How often do you get out?
I don't ride her during the winter because the brakes are still rubbish, and I don't like riding in the wet. And I have to ride her quite, you know, she's a little bit of a, yeah. I have to ride her in a very certain way. And but I ride her during the summer. I don't do long trips, but she's great for kind of pootling around the small country roads on a lovely Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon.
Oh yeah, and, of course.
So it's nice and gentle. You know, she's had a hard life. So
did you take the cases off?
I actually threw the boxes away.
Oh, you did.
I know, it's the one regret that I have. I actually threw them away. It was I think I held on to them for about 10 years. And then I had to move out of where I was living in London, and they were stored up in the attic, and I had to move all this stuff, and it was another very hard time of my life, a difficult time of my life, and I just looked at these panniers and I thought, well, I'm never going to use them again. Nobody's interested in my journey. What on earth am I going to keep them for? So I just took them up and I just threw them out on a kind of builder's, you know, skip. I know. I feel really bad.
Wow. So now, briefly, let's talk about this. You're an architect, and you renovated a water tower, and that's where you live.
Yeah, it's a Victorian. I mean, it's really more like a folly. So it's a brick octagonal building, 130 foot high. And I bought it as a complete ruin, and then I spent 7 years converting it into my house.
Wow.
It was a real labor of love, I can tell you.
Oh. Wow. It must be very... And that's where you are right now.
That's where I still live, yes.
Wow. That must be special. I did see you were on Ride with Norman Reedus.
I was. That's right.
Yes, and I did see that. It's the first chance I actually had to see photographs of the place. It's beautiful. You did a wonderful job.
Yeah.
How much hands-on were you with that?
Well, I did a lot of the building work myself.
Did you really? Wow, look at you.
Well, because at the time, well, I kind of believe that there's actually nothing that most people can't do. If you just, if you can read a book and you got two hands and you know, you can, it's not difficult. So I just bought myself a DIY book and I just learned. I taught myself plumbing, electrics. I was building walls, floors. I laid all the timber flooring, tiling. I did everything. And,
wow.
I mean, there were certain bits of it, like doing all the external brick repairs, which where I had to get these specialists in.
Yeah.
You know, there were elements of the work that I had to get. Obviously, I had to get people in to do. But anything that I could do. So I probably did about half of the building work myself, which is why it took seven years, because I was working.
I know all about that kind of stuff, but that's amazing. So you fix your own motorcycles, you build your own house, and very impressive. So how can people learn more about you and what you're up to and get a hold of your book?
Well, my book was published in the UK in 2017, and then in 2018, I was 18 or 19, I can't remember, it was published in America by Octane Press, and so it's available on Amazon. There's also an audiobook available, a Kindle version available, the ebook. So yeah, if you can read my story, it's all there.
And of course, you got your website, which is elsbethbeard.com.
Absolutely,
check that out. And any last comments or advice to riders who are thinking of doing such a journey?
Well, I would say just get out there and do it. And it will never be the right time. I mean, if you think, when I left, I was 23 years old with zero experience. I had an 8-year-old bike with 45,000 miles on it. And I had £2,500. And that, not one of those things was kind of right. But I just left and I managed it. So, you know, I would say just get out there and do it. And, you know, don't wait for the perfect time, because the perfect time will probably never come, and you'll never do it. So,
well, Elsbeth, I want to thank you very, very much for being on the show. I greatly enjoyed listening to you talk. I loved your book. I can't say enough about it. But thank you very much for joining me and talking to me about this.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's quite all right. All right, then. Well, listen, you take care, and you ride safe and keep going with that architecture.
Okay, thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me and Elspeth here on episode 203
where we talked about her journey around the world by motorcycle back in 1982. To learn more about Elspeth, you can go to her website at elspethbeard.com. Links will be in the show notes and on the Motorcycle Men website, motorcyclemen.us. Don't forget to check out our fellow podcasters, YouTubers, bloggers, and vloggers, whose links you will also find on our links page. All of these media outlets, many more out there, do great things to promote and encourage our sport and our passion. So that's our links page on the motorcyclemen.us website. There's a lot more links on there just from our podcasters. A lot of our vendors and people that we've dealt with are on there. So please, by all means, go check them out. Coming up next on the Motorcycle Men podcast, an interview with someone to tell us all about Roadside America. Join us next on episode 204. So, from Tim, Buck 2, Chris the Joker, Justin Shoes, and me, Ted Wrongway, your host, thanks for listening to the Motorcycle Men podcast, where we say stupid crap so you don't have to. Enjoy your ride, kids.